Well, turn again, please, to the 13th Psalm as we continue looking at the Psalms on our Sunday evening. Psalm 13 this evening. And once again, there are three things that I want to highlight from this psalm, three things to which I want to draw your attention. And first of all, then this evening, a repeated question. A repeated question. And this is verses 1 and 2. And the question to which I'm referring then is the question, how long? Which occurs no fewer than four times in this opening paragraph. How long? How long? How long? How long? It's not, of course, an uncommon question in everyday speech. We use it all the time. How long does this joint of meat need in the oven? How long is the ref going to add on at the end of the 90 minutes? How long have I got left on my pay-as-you-go account on my mobile phone? And so we could go on. It's not a necessarily profound question, is it? The question, how long? But it can sometimes be a profound question. And it is a profound question, I think, on David's lips here in Psalm 13. That's indicated by the very first occurrence of the question in this psalm. Just have a look at it there, the first occurrence at the beginning of verse 1. And two things, I think, stand out about it. First of all, it's addressed to God. How long, O Lord? A cookbook can answer the question, how long does this joint of meat need in the oven? A stopwatch can answer the question, how long is the ref going to add on at the end of the 90 minutes? An automated voice on your mobile can answer the question, how long have I got left on my account? But David's how long here concerns such deep matters that only Almighty God himself can answer the question, how long, O Lord? And then the other thing that stands out about this first occurrence is that how long is the whole of the question here, isn't it? It's not how long will ... It's not how long must ... It's not how long until ... It's simply how long, O Lord? It's more of a groan, isn't it, than anything else. There's unmistakable anguish about it. There's unmistakable bewilderment about it. There's unmistakable agitation about it. And so I'm saying then that you need go no further than the very opening four words of this psalm to appreciate that however bland and unremarkable the question how long might be in other contexts, here in Psalm 13, we're talking about a very, very weighty question that David is asking. Well, what's giving rise to it then? Well, I think we can identify three things. First of all, his spiritual situation. David's spiritual situation. Verse 1. Will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? It's the foundational privilege, it's the supreme glory, it's the purest essence of being a believer, isn't it? Having this deep and intimate relationship with God, engaging with him, experiencing him, enjoying him, reveling in this communion and fellowship that you have with him, the nearness of God, the presence of God is the indispensable pulse beat of your very existence as a believer, so that even if everything else goes, you're happy so long as you have him. That is the testimony of a believer. And that's what makes these words here in verse 1 so painful. You may remember how a few years ago the late Bob Monkhouse lost his joke book. And however bad you might have thought his jokes were, you couldn't help feeling a little bit sorry for him. It must be rather painful for a comedian to lose his joke book. But how much more painful for a believer to feel as though he has lost his God, to feel as though God has gone off somewhere and left you alone. To feel that God is deliberately avoiding eye contact with you. What else do you have left as a believer in those kinds of circumstances? And it's a pain to which perhaps many of us can relate, because we go through times in our Christian lives, don't we? We go through times when we keep on attending church and we keep on reading our Bibles and we keep on praying, and yet we aren't spiritually animated by those experiences, and we don't feel strangely warmed within, and we don't feel the love of God being shed abroad in our hearts, and it just feels as though God is uninterested in our attempts to draw near to Him. It just feels as though God is holding us at arm's length and withholding so much of Himself from us. C.H. Spurgeon puts it in this way. He writes, "As the pastor of a large church, I have to observe a great variety of experiences. And I note that some whom I greatly love and esteem, who are in my judgment among the very choicest of God's people, nevertheless travel most of the way to heaven by night. They do not rejoice in the light of God's countenance, though they trust in the shadow of His wings. They are on the way to eternal light, and yet they walk in darkness. Heirs of a measureless estate of bliss, they are now without the small change and spending money of comfort which would make their present existence delightful. It is idle," he concludes, "to attempt to judge a man's real character before God by his present state of feeling." We see here that it's David's spiritual situation partly which is giving rise to his anguished question. Secondly, it's his mental situation. He continues, "How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and every day have sorrow in my heart?" I have a friend who used to have a red setter, or is it an Irish setter? I think it's the same thing, isn't it? But anyway, he used to have one of those, and it was in many ways a lovely dog. It had a very affectionate character, but suffice to say, it wasn't an animal blessed with a great deal of brains. And so, for instance, my friend would sometimes be sitting on his armchair, and the dog would come and to stand by him and lean its whole weight against him, against his legs. And then after a few minutes, perhaps, my friend would change position, move his legs, and the dog would just topple over, looking rather silly in the process. It wasn't an animal blessed with a great deal of brains. And it's a great privilege, isn't it, to be a human being? To be this human being who can reason and can think logically and rationally, who can work things out and apply reason to situations. It's a great thing to have those faculties with which God has endowed us as human beings, as the very apex of His creation order. But is it not the case that there are times in our lives when our minds just seem to be constantly on overdrive? We just can't give them any rest. We can't switch them off. And at those times, you almost wish that you did have the intellectual capacities of an Irish setter. You almost wish that you were some lesser being in God's creation order, because there's just this constant mental activity and you can't shut it down. And that, I think it's something like this that David is experiencing here, that perhaps partly because of his spiritual situation that we've just commented on, and partly because of the third situation that we're going to come to in a moment, his mind, his head is just constantly flooded with thoughts. And he says he's having to wrestle with them. There's so many of them. They're so crowding his head. He's having to try to wrestle with them in order to organize them. And sometimes, perhaps we can relate to that in our lives. Just so much going on in our heads, having to wrestle with our thoughts, and it does leave that sorrow to which he refers in the second line of verse 2, that sorrow in our hearts, a cloud over us every single day. So there's his spiritual situation, his mental situation, but then thirdly, his life situation. By this I mean then his circumstances. He concludes this opening paragraph, "How long will my enemy triumph over me?" David's circumstances here aren't rosy. He has an enemy. We don't know whether it's Saul, whether it's Absalom, whether it's some other enemy at some other stage in his life, but David has an enemy. The Irish singer Bono, during a period in the 1980s, because of his controversial political views that he had stated, he had Irish folk, particularly in the United States, who were even issuing death threats against him. And in his book, Conversations with Bono, he talks about how during that period he had to go on tour in the United States. And he'd be playing to these packed arenas, some of them indoor arenas, and he would go out on stage in the evening and he would have this thought in his mind, "I wonder if there's somebody in the rafters with a gun who's going to shoot me at some point during this concert." And he would just have to close his eyes and get on and sing and try and forget about it. But can you imagine that? Can you imagine having an enemy, having someone who's after you, who wants to kill you? And that's the circumstance that David then is facing here. And he even feels that this enemy is somehow in the ascendancy. "How long will my enemy triumph over me?" Imagine David going to bed each night with that thought, "There's someone after me. There's someone who wants my life, who wants my blood. And this person has more resources than I do. And this person has more techniques than I do. And this person, humanly speaking, seems like they're closing in and will inevitably get me at some point soon." David's circumstances here aren't rosy. And perhaps you can relate to that as well, not necessarily an enemy, but to your circumstances being difficult. Perhaps in your case, bereavement. Perhaps in your case, ill health. Perhaps in your case, marital breakdown. Perhaps in your case, some level of abuse at some point in your life. And you know the anguish, the trial, the hardship of your circumstances being difficult. And I'm saying then that these were three things that were giving rise to this question. How long? David's spiritual situation, this sense that God was far from him. David's mental situation, just this constant flooding of thoughts, having to wrestle with them. And David's life situation, his circumstances, his enemy who was after him. And I'm saying then that perhaps for similar reasons, you and I have at times felt like and perhaps even uttered that question, "How long, O Lord?" A repeated question. Secondly this evening, a desperate desire. A desperate desire, verses 3 and 4. When I was at primary school and at the top end of primary school, Christmas there was a Christmas party, but because we were the upper end of primary school, the party wasn't during the day as it was for the younger children. The party was in the evening, and it meant that you could actually have the afternoon off school. You could go home for the afternoon and then return later on for the party. Now, I absolutely hated Christmas parties, and so I remember on this one occasion going home at lunchtime, as we were all allowed to do, and persuading my mum to let me stay at home and not go in the evening to this party. And I think I thought that this wouldn't cause any problems whatsoever. My mum was the chairman of the governors. That generally let me off getting into too much trouble in school, whatever I did. And so I thought that, as on other occasions, this wouldn't cause any problem. And I remember the next day going into school and the headmaster, Mr. Chilton, coming up to me and asking me, "Where were you last night, Dan?" And I remember laughing. I thought it was a rhetorical question. Thought, no problem here. Rhetorical question, just laughing. And then I remember that realization, partly from the fact he asked the question a second time, partly from the tone of his voice, partly from the look in his eye, that realization that he genuinely wanted an explanation of why I hadn't been there. And at first sight, you might think here in these first two verses that David is asking a rhetorical question. How long, O Lord? How long? How long? It's just a rhetorical question. His answer, he's not expecting any answer. Until you come to verse 3. Look on me and answer, O Lord, my God. David actually expects an answer to this question. He wants God to actually set a timetable here. He wants God to actually say, okay, I'll relieve you of all these problems by next Tuesday or by 2 weeks in 2 weeks' time. He wants God to actually answer his how long question and set a date as to when he's going to relieve him of these problems. And not only that, but David has reasons why God should do this. He has reasons why God needs, God must relieve him of these problems. It's not just, in David's view, a matter of his own personal comfort and convenience. No, in David's view, it's a matter of his survival. It's a matter of life and death. Look at how he continues. Give light to my eyes, by which I think he means bring gladness, bring cheer back to me, Lord. Or he says, I will sleep in death. In other words, he's saying, if this continues, this mental agitation I'm facing, this cloud over me, I can't handle it for too much longer. It's going to literally kill me. It's going to send me to my grave. It's going to undo me, he's saying to God. And then he continues, my enemy will say, I have overcome him, and my foes will rejoice when I fall. And so he's saying here that if this enemy continues to hound me and harass me, he's going to get me soon, God. I'm going to fall. But, and that's a strong word. He means I'm going to fall beyond recovery. I'm going to be got. I'm going to be had by this enemy. And so you see, David then has this desperate desire that God should actually answer his question, relieve him of his problems. And he has these reasons why God must do this. It's a matter of survival. It's a matter of life and death. If God doesn't, then David has had it. He's going to be undone. Either his worries will kill him and send him to his grave, or if not, his enemy will get him and make him fall beyond recovery. It's often how we think, isn't it? I referred a few weeks ago to that verse which we read earlier on in our service this evening in 1 Corinthians 10. 1 Corinthians 10, 13. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. And I talked about how it's God's definition of what we can bear rather than our definition of what we can bear. But that's hard, isn't it? It's hard to practically take that on board. It's, I think, one of the most difficult areas of Christian living, perhaps. Handing over to God the decision about how much we can bear. Because like David, we think that we can only bear so much. If this continues, if this situation continues as it is now, I won't be able to handle it anymore. It will undo me, it will finish me off. We think that we know how much we can bear, and it can be one of the hardest things, handing that decision over to God. You are the one who knows how much we can bear. In all kinds of other areas, we're happy to acknowledge that we know nothing and God knows everything. When it comes to the secrets of the universe, how the planets and how the planets work, and how what the ocean consists of, and all the different secrets of this great universe that God has constructed at so many levels, we're happy to acknowledge we know nothing, he knows everything. But when it comes to our own personal capacity for endurance, well, we think we know something at that level. Because we know ourselves, we think. And we think, well, I know how much I can bear. I know that if I go beyond this point, that'll be too much. I won't be able to handle it. And Paul is saying there in 1 Corinthians 10 that no, God knows, and he is the one who will take the decision as to how much we can or cannot bear. And David then needed to learn that lesson. Here he is, almost bargaining with God. I need you to relieve me, otherwise this is going to happen. And as I say, it's often where we find ourselves. And we need to keep going to 1 Corinthians 10:13. God knows how much we can bear. And if he is still keeping me in this situation, it must be because he knows I can bear it. And at the point when he knows I cannot bear it anymore, he will relieve me. He is sovereign over my struggles and my difficulties. So we've seen then a repeated question, this question, how long? A desperate desire, this desire that God will relieve him of his troubles. But then thirdly and finally, a sudden change, verses 5 and 6. And on the face of things, it seems here, doesn't it, that God must have answered David, that he must have taken David's arguments in verses 3 and 4 seriously and relieved him of his troubles, because the tone is so different. No longer the anguish and the desperation. Now David is so confident and so buoyant, and it seems, therefore, that God must indeed have answered him and relieved him of the problems of which he's complained in the opening paragraph. But when you examine it more closely, I don't think that's the case, because notice that the subject of these three clauses that we have in verses 5 and 6 isn't God, is it? It isn't God has done this, and God has done that, and God has done the next thing. God has relieved me of my troubles. Now the subject of these three clauses is I, my heart, I. And I think that's indicating to us that the sudden change here in this last paragraph isn't that God has relieved him of his troubles. It isn't that God has intervened and God has done something. It's rather that David's perspective has changed. That's what's happened. The sudden change resides in David's own perspective. Let's just look quickly at the three clauses in turn. First of all, but I trust in your unfailing love. Now this word unfailing love, it's a wonderful Old Testament word. And it really belongs in the context of covenants, the context of a commitment being made by one person to another. It could perhaps be translated, but I trust in your covenant love. I trust in your sworn love, in your pledged love, in your committed love. And you see what David is saying here then. He's saying that even though, as I have acknowledged in verse 1, even though I feel like you are far off, God, even though I don't sense that you love me, and that you want me, and that you care for me, even though I don't have those emotions and those sensations, I am going to trust not in my feelings, but in your sworn commitment, in your pledge, in your covenant promises. You have said that you love me, and you will love me with a love that will not let me go. You have said that you will love me with an everlasting love, and I am going to trust that. I'm going to trust your promised, committed, pledged love, regardless of what I'm feeling, regardless of whether or not I can see your face, regardless of my emotional state, I am going to trust in your promise that you will love me forever. I suppose you see and experience a little bit of this in human relationships, when you're courting and things can often seem so insecure, and sometimes just because the other person doesn't phone you at quite the same time that they usually do, they don't perhaps look at you in quite the way they normally look at you, you suddenly think, well, this whole relationship is up in the air and it's all falling apart, and there's a crisis here. But once you're married, then there's such a deeper level of security, because there's been that commitment made between you that I will love you, we will love each other until death us do part. So that even when perhaps those things aren't there, the look and so on, we trust in that commitment, in that sworn, pledged love. And that's what David is doing here. He's resolving that even when he doesn't feel loved by God, he's going to lean the weight of his soul upon God's promises. I do love you and I will love you forever. I suppose it's what Spurgeon mentioned in that quote about those people that he could think of in his congregation. And he says that they do not rejoice in the light of God's countenance, though they trust in the shadow of his wings. That's what David is doing here. He doesn't rejoice in the light of God's countenance at this particular point. He feels like God is far away. But he still trusts in the shadow of his wings. He still trusts in a love that will not let him go. The second clause, my heart rejoices in your salvation. And David is saying here, I think, that even when there are all these thoughts flooding my mind and there's this cloud over me, there's sorrow in my heart, I am resolving that I am going to focus on the one thing from which joy may always be derived, the one thing that doesn't change, the one thing that is untouchable by circumstances and by change and decay, which is your salvation. That's always there to rejoice. And whatever else is going on, that your salvation is always there to rejoice in. And I'm resolving that I am going to focus on that more. I'm going to contemplate that more. I'm going to derive my joy from the one thing that is always there to derive joy from, your salvation. How much more reason do we have than David to do that? Because we know so much more of God's salvation, don't we? In his case, it was shadowy promises. Salvation pictured in animal sacrifices and in priests and in a temple building. And we now have had all of those shadows stripped away, all the pictures, all the types removed, because they've been fulfilled in the real thing. Jesus Christ has come and has died on Calvary's cross, bearing our sin. And we can read the Gospels, and we can see that salvation described for us in almost excruciating detail as we come to the passion of our Saviour. And we too then can resolve, my heart is going to rejoice in your salvation. Whatever thoughts are flooding my mind, whatever reasons for sorrow I have, there's this one thing that doesn't change. I'm going to fix my mind upon Calvary's salvation. And then the third clause, I will sing to the Lord, for he has been good to me. Where David is saying, I think, even when circumstances aren't rosy, even when I have an enemy who is seeking my life and seems to be closing in on me, even then I'm going to resolve to count my blessings, to recall all the ways in which you have been good to me, God. All the things that are rosy in my life. All the provisions that you have made for me. All the deliverances that you have brought my way. I'm going to sing of those things instead of complaining of the difficult circumstance. I'm going to recall the good circumstances which you have lavished upon me through my life. And so you see what I'm saying then, that we've no reason to believe here in this last paragraph that the circumstances David has outlined in the first paragraph have been removed. No reason to believe that. No reason to believe that David's life has suddenly become so much easier. But rather, David's perspective has changed. He's resolving now to do these three things. And just in conclusion then, it's reminding us, isn't it, that on the one hand the Bible isn't an unrealistic book. The Bible isn't a book which presents the life of faith as something easy and casual and effortless, a stroll in the park. No, the Bible presents the life of faith as a life in which at times you will cry out, how long? The great David himself did. And if he did, then doubtless all of us will. The Bible doesn't give us this expectation that it will all be just this cheery, easy carry-on, the life of faith. No, it's not unrealistic. It shows us that there will be struggles. There will be profoundly dark times when we will cry out with David, how long? It's not an unrealistic book. But then on the other hand, the Bible isn't an unhelpful book, which simply tells us that and then gives us nothing to answer it. But no, the Bible, here in Psalm 13 particularly, through David's example, gently encourages us what to do in those situations, how to address those situations. And in particular then, to resolve, on the one hand, that we're going to trust in God's covenant love, whether or not we feel it. And secondly, that we're going to rejoice in that unchangeable salvation, whatever we have to be gloomy about. And thirdly, that we're going to sing of the way God has blessed us, even when there are circumstances that are very, very trying and difficult. And I trust then that we will know God's help in our dark times to make those resolutions and those determinations. Amen. And we're going to close then singing this psalm that we've just considered, Psalm 13. How long will you forget me, Lord? Will you forget always? Psalm 13.